Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's is Tuesday, August 5th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Greed, Possession by Possession. Luke chapter 12, verse 13 through 21. Session 2 of Seven Deadly Sins, a Bible study with Brad Beenow. Number BIB 2003-07. Let's listen in.
My name is Brad Beenow. I teach at Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio. I teach pastoral theology, which is pastoral care and counseling and a few other related type things. But here for last week and this week, I'm teaching Seven Deadly Sins. This is not a how to do it. Everybody always wants to know about that. If there's any how to do it in this, I hope it's when we get to the virtues that I hope to suggest we might cultivate that are useful in combating the deadly sins. My assumption is none of us really need any instruction on how to do the deadly sins. We are all of us mostly expert in that, although we may not quite know what it is that we're doing. And that's one of the reasons for these sessions, is to lift up and illuminate some of the ways that we sin, perhaps not even knowing that that's the label that we ought to put on the kind of attitudes or behaviors that we're all about. I won't try to summarize everything that has transpired. We're moving through these sins one at a time. Just a couple things might be helpful. When we started out, we talked about sin a little bit in general, and one of the things that we said was that it's always important to keep in mind that sin is both a general existential sort of category, a description of the fallenness, the brokenness of the world, what the confession means when it says that we are in bondage to this thing called sin and we cannot free ourselves from it. That's a given in a fallen world. At the same time, that we're also all culpably involved in the perpetuation of that situation by committing various sins. In the plural. So we have our own attitudes and behaviors that flow out of that general sort of condition that we're all born into. Come on in. One of the general themes of what we're trying to do here is look at a theme that Lutherans have often not paid too much attention to, which is the notion of sanctification. Lutherans are experts when it comes to justification. We've got that down pat. That's our gift to the world and the church. But there is something in our tradition about sanctification. In other words, what do you do after you are justified? Is that it? You just roll over and play dead? Or are you supposed to do something with that gift of justification? That, of course, always gets tricky. We're easily tempted to think that it's by virtue of our hard work toward sanctification that we earn our justification. That's not the case. We're justified as a free gift from God, and then as a result of that free gift, what are you going to do? Gerhard Ferdi, a Lutheran theologian who taught at Luther Seminary for many years, was famous for saying that the whole deal is, what are you going to do now that you understand you don't have to do anything? What are you free to do? That's the question. So that's what we're about. And today, we're going to take a look at greed and related issues, but before we do that, why don't we let's begin with a word of prayer. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let's pray. Gracious God, we rest comfortably here in this mountain valley, in the wonders of your creation, in the gifts that you've given to us. Life slows down just enough, perhaps, that we can catch our breath and see things more clearly. For all these gifts, we're grateful and we give you thanks. And we know that in the next breath, we need to confess how tempted we are and how often we give in to that temptation to misuse these good gifts of your creation, to act as if we were their creator rather than us being your creatures. We confess our desire to accumulate and to hoard and to try to define ourselves with things rather than through the baptismal waters and gifts that you have sent into our lives. Open our eyes and our hearts and our minds and our ears that we might take in all of the gospel that you can give us in this next hour to set us free to be your sanctified people in the world. We pray in Christ's name. Amen. Well, I'm I'm sort of girding up for this session because there's so much here, and I have a strong hunch that we could talk about this till about 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'll do my best to kind of keep us generally in line with the outline I put on the board there, but I want you to climb in with your questions and comments, and those are the main points I'm hoping to hit. We'll talk about greed, we'll look at the potential positive upside first, look at the biblical passage, then as we've been doing, try to do a little bit of human development work, see where greed starts to take hold of us in life, and then finish with some thoughts about the virtues that are helpful here. A couple of years ago, when I first started to put a course together on the seven deadly sins for students at Trinity, I got to thinking about greed and so forth, and pretty quickly I realized that most of what I had learned about this deadly sin, I mean in a positive sense, and what I'd learned about why it was bad, I learned here at Holden Village in past years when I had been here. Holden, I think, does a wonderful job of bringing lifestyle issues into focus and helping us see those more clearly. So in one sense, maybe I don't need to say that much. A lot of this stuff you're probably already familiar with and have soaked up kind of by osmosis by being at home. But I hope we can shed a little bit of new light and send us all away with a few more things to think about. I should say, a couple years ago when I was on sabbatical, I had a little more time at home, and our daughter was about, what, 4 then, I guess. That was the year that we watched Mary Poppins over and over and over and over and over. How that is, once you can't get enough of a good thing. And I must have watched Mary Poppins for about the 10 millionth time. When I finally caught a line in that movie that Mary Poppins says to the children, remember the scene where Jane and Michael are, they're wanting to play games, and Mary Poppins says, "Let's play tidy up the nursery," and they think, "Oh no, that's just work." And, you know, and she says, "No, it'll be fun," and then she teaches them how to do it magically, and everything jumps back in the drawer. And when they're all done, little Michael says, "I want to play it again." And Mary Poppins says, "No, no, Michael, enough is as good as a feast." I don't know how I missed that, seeing that so many times before, but that's a great piece of wisdom by which we can all live. Enough is as good as a feast. And the trick, of course, is knowing what the adequate definition of enough is. We all have a vision of what a feast looks like, you know, which is just as much excess as you can imagine. Defining what is enough, I think, is perhaps the principal struggle of life in this country at this time. It is not an easy thing to do, and one person's enough isn't quite the same as another person's enough. But then again, I'm not sure they're all that far apart either, as we'll see. Well. Let's start with the upside, however. I need to say one other thing. We've been talking about these seven things as deadly sins, because that's classically how the tradition has delivered them to us. But I think one of the things that I've certainly discovered along the way is they are really, at best, only potential sins. They are more kind of attitudes or potential dispositions, we might say. I think we might better call them the deadly dispositions. Because in and through each one of these issues, there is a potential healthy element, or upside, a positive something. And again, we've talked in sessions past here about the fact that evil only exists because it has something good to feed on. It only exists in contrast with something that's good. And so to get at what's deadly about the deadly part of the sin, it's helpful, I think, to put into some relief what is potentially positive here. So two notions where greed is involved that I think are potentially good gifts to us, but when misused, go bad. And that's another general truth that I hold to here, is that any good gift when carried to excess can always become bad. Any good thing when done too much, I can't think of any exceptions to that, can overwhelm you and become bad. Everything in moderation except moderation, and in that, the excessive. That's
break down.
Self-expression. I think God of creation gives us both a desire and the capability to find ways to define who we are and to express ourselves, to discover what is uniquely us and bring that into expression. And I think some aspects of that can come about because of the possessions that come to us in life. We partly define ourselves by the kind of clothes we wear, the sort of place we choose to live, the kind of books we buy and read, the kind of carpet we have on our living room floor, etc. And I don't even think you need to get into the principle of private property. I mean, as near as I can tell when I read Genesis, the vision of shalom for creation was probably that there wasn't anything like private property to get started. That's a more or less a concession to sinful human nature. But even in a world where Adam and Eve were free to take of whatever they want, I assume it was part of that was they found they had favorite trees or favorite corners of the garden, whatever, I don't know. That gave them some means of discovering who they were and differentiating themselves from one another and so forth. Possessions can be a legitimate way to express our identity. If you think about that, you know, I think you could think of certain things you've had in your life and probably things that were not all that expensive, but someone gave you a gift that it was special, or at some special moment on a trip you bought this or that something, and you know, it helped. It helped others understand who you were, and it helped you understand yourself. And that, I would say, nothing necessarily bad in that. Just a short example of that. I'm a great fan of baseball and so forth, and when I was a kid, like many kids, collected baseball cards. And I can remember a day and age when collecting baseball cards was something you did just because it was fun. You did it for its own sake, and you just enjoyed sitting around your living room floor looking at pictures and statistics and so forth. Now I notice every year pretty much I find a way to get to spring training in Arizona, get out of Ohio for a couple days over spring break. And it's often the case that I'll see kids 6, 8, 10 years old, they've got these huge notebooks full of all their baseball cards, all nicely tucked in the little plastic sleeves, you know, in absolutely pristine condition. And they're standing in line, pestering Major League Baseball players to sign their cards for them. And it's not out of a love of baseball, and it's not out of a love of learning statistics. It's because they know down the road there's real money in this. And you'll hear kids say to players, the players will always say, "What's your name?" And they'll say, "It's Tommy." But don't put Tommy on there. Just sign your name. Because kids know that if an autograph is personalized, the value goes way down. So they don't want, you know, they don't want Jason Giambi signing, "Hi, Tommy. Best wishes, Jason Giambi." They just want Jason Giambi. I just find that so sad and disheartening. Something that has been fun has now been commercialized. This whole memorabilia collecting stuff is all about money. Kids approach this now like it's the stock market. I got so-and-so's rookie card, you know, from 83. It's worth 250. Whatever. It's just hard. Okay. Second potential upside, or positive element to greed, is the principle of stewardship. Biblical notion is that God does place creation into human hands to have dominion over, which does not mean to dominate, but in the literal meaning of that word, it means to care for. But we are to hold the world, I mean to nurture, to care for, to work with it, to bring certain parts of it to fruition and so forth. One can hold obsessively, of course, and that's where greed starts to enter in. But when one can hold gently and let go appropriately when it's time and so forth, then this is a biblical principle of stewardship, and that's part of the healing of the world, is a conscious, healthy notion of what stewardship is all about. I just use another baseball analogy, I think one of the things that drives me crazy these days is, I mean, baseball has so many problems now, but much of it has to do with ownership. And that all starts with me, the very term, to be an owner in baseball, I think is part of the problem. How can you own an institution? This is a national pastime. One is at best a steward of a franchise that you're supposed to nurture. Hey, if you make money out of it, I'm fine with that, and so forth. But George Steinbrenner really doesn't anymore own the New York Yankees than you or I do, I don't think. I mean, I think that's part of the national fabric of the culture and so forth. Sports in general would be better if the people who call themselves owners would behave more like stewards. I think in the end, they'd probably make more money, too. I mean, they would care for the institution better. But how the business of stewardship gets confused with ownership. See how that works and becomes very problematic. So I think, you know, having things, collecting things, being stewards over things, in and of itself, fine. We are, in fact, supposed to have some power and authority over material things. They are not, however, supposed to gain power over us. Hence the title for today, Possession by Possessions. Well, okay, that's where we're starting to get into greed as a deadly sin. But let me just pause there. Does those healthy elements make sense, or can you think of others that might fit there somehow? Give you at least something to work with to get going, I hope. Okay, well, so where does it go? Oh, sorry, I can't see up there. Yeah.
I hear in what you're saying the difference and the real the change in attitude that stewardship brings to ownership. I'm from Boulder, Colorado, and the city council passed an ordinance that no longer do people own dogs or pets.
Oh.
They are pet guardians. And although, you know, you might chuckle at that, it really changes people's sense of being stewards and the care that they give for their animals, as opposed to owning and what that implies.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And I imagine that was for some people in the community a pretty radical idea, and they wondered what all these animal rights nuts were all about, all this sort of thing. But theologically, I think that's pretty much on target. We are the guardians and caretakers of all of creation. Now, when they pass an ordinance that says you don't really own your property, you're just the guardian of, you know, 365 North Cassingham Road where I live. In a sense, private property is a concession to our sinful nature, where we wouldn't be able to stay out of one another's stuff, so we legally define how much is mine and whatnot. But and that's a great example and a really interesting civic move there. Yeah.
Why do you have a problem with your property being a guardian of your property? Why is that a problem?
I think in a fallen, sinful world, I mean, this is I can never remember, is this the kingdom on the left or kingdom on the right, whichever. Governments and laws are instituted in a civil sense to keep us safe. And in that sense, I think there's room in the world for some kind of ordinance that helps us define where my property line and my responsibilities are, as opposed to somebody else's. I mean, theologically, I would say I'm private property is certainly problematic, but it's a concession, I think, to our fallenness. Does that make sense? Sorry, I can't see very well.
I know.
Does that make sense?
I guess what I was thinking of is out where we live, where everyone has acreage, they take on this, I can do anything I want on my property,
right.
And that whole image of guardian is a nice image,
right,
that we are caretaking for this piece, but it is not just ours to, you know,
right.
So I like that image of guardianship.
Yeah, and I do too, and I don't think the fact that I'm able to legally go down and register a piece of property with my boundaries means that I ought to be able to do any old thing I want to it. I think if government gives me the concession of owning that, then the government also has every right Corporately, we as government have every right to set, impose upon ourselves restrictions about what we're going to let ourselves do with that property. You can't drill for oil in any old place, and you can't strip mine any old thing, and you can't deforest acreage left, you know, that sort of thing. We could just get the strip malls, and, anyway. Okay, so where does all this start to become deadly then? One author on Deadly Sins has pointed out that greed is maybe not so much, this is really interesting, not so much the love of possessions as the love of possessing. It's the act of possessing. Now, let's get this real close to home here and make all of ourselves uncomfortable. If we're honest, in the heart of hearts, I think we've all experienced at one time or another the sensation of we're on the way to the mall, and we have a vague notion of what we're going for. There's a couple things we need, and we're going to pick up, but we're sort of open to finding something else. We're sort of open to doing some shopping, to spending some money. And we know that there's a sense in that of feeling somewhat empowered or better. It's like comfort food. It's like eating Oreos. We'll talk about that tomorrow. there's a feeling that comes along with the ability to spend money in exchange for possessions. That's the best I can define. I'm not quite sure how to describe that. My guess is that's not a wild, rampant sin for very many of us. You know, maybe for a few of us, but probably not. It's probably just a low-grade sort of thing. But if you really think about it, you can get in touch with that sensation. It can be more about the act of possessing than the actual possession itself. Sometimes this has been called covetousness, actually, in the tradition. And this deadly sin has been grouped with others like gluttony and lust as being sins of the body, sins that affect us more physically. Although, as we'll point out tomorrow, one of the interesting things that differentiates greed and gluttony, because there's a lot of similarity here, is that gluttony at least has an outside limit. I mean, you can only take in so much and you pass out, you die, you fall asleep or whatever. Greed is not like that. There's no physical limit imposed upon our greed. You can keep acquiring, possessing, and taking in, and, well, as we'll see in a moment in the parable, only at the very end of it all do you find out perhaps what a horrendous mistake it was. So that's an important distinction, I think. There are some classic, I won't spend too much time on this because we want to get on to other things, some classic slight derivatives of greed. Let me just point to two of those. One is miserliness. We don't talk about that very much anymore. We all read Silas Marner back in ninth grade or something. On Friday, actually, we're going to talk about Dickens' Christmas Carol and Scrooge, who's another famous miser. But what's interesting is that the English root of the word miser is the same as the root for the word miserable. So think about that in terms of this being a deadly sin. Another possible derivative is what we've, in contemporary life, come to call conspicuous consumption. That's maybe one of the modern varieties of greed. And one of the things about that is that our tendency toward conspicuous consumption is often not based on actual wealth. It's one thing to be greedy if you're Donald Trump or something and you have a bazillion dollars and you can throw it around on buildings and yachts and whatever you want. It's quite another thing actually not to have much wealth, but to practice your conspicuous consumption with plastic or other borrowed forms of money and so forth. It's a way of kind of seeking or displaying our sense of self-importance that's not grounded in reality. And I mean, there are many deadly consequences out of that. And I mentioned covetousness as a. There were times when covetousness was used as the name for the deadly sin instead of greed, but avarice also, same sort of thing. But according, at least to the parable we're going to read here in a moment, all of these different approaches are seen as abuses of our relationship to the material world. In fact, Jesus' words here are, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. So there are many forms, apparently, that Jesus was mindful of. Let me just point to two others. A couple of years ago, in the Lutheran magazine, H. George Anderson, who was the presiding bishop of the ELCA at the time, had a great little article about greed, which he called Greed in Disguise, Let's Check Our Cravings. And he pointed out that there are two kinds of greed, the fast kind and the slow kind, and he used as an analogy something that he had learned from some chemist. Any chemists here? I've been dying. All right, good. Tell me if this is true, because if it's not, I'm going to write me to George Anderson, and then I'll stop using this. But apparently, he said that that a flame and rust are basically the same process, a kind of oxidization. Is that true?
Right.
All right. So it's an oxidization process that's going to consume and eventually destroy. One happens more quickly, however, and rust happens very slowly over time. But in the end, the corrosion or the destruction comes to the same end. Okay. Well, he pointed out that there's a kind of fast-burning combustible greed that the famous and the wealthy may practice, but there's also this sort of gradual, slow, corrosive, rusting type greed. Most of us probably don't practice the fast-burning combustible kind. We don't do it on a very grand scale. We're more into the slow, barely perceptible, corrosive sort of thing. And he pointed out that, he said, greed is not one of your fascinating, flamboyant sins. In fact, it's so distasteful, it often travels in disguise. And so he said, here's a couple ways it does that. Sometimes greed is disguised as a plea for fairness. We say, I'm not greedy, now don't get me wrong, but it's not really that I want more money or more benefits. It's just that I think I ought to be treated the same as everybody else in the organization. I really ought to get fair compensation for my level of expertise and my years of experience and, you know, comparable responsibilities to so-and-so down the hall or wherever it is in the next, you know, office over. All true to some extent, but we also know how easily that can slide over and be a cover for what the real truth is, which is I just want more. Or, he says, sometimes our greed comes designed simply as ambition. And we say things like, what I know, what I can do is really important. And, you know, I'm going to do what I have to do to be sure that the world benefits from what I can offer. And I'm going to work to put myself in a position to be able to offer that. And that we may have some really altruistic motives behind that kind of thinking. And then again, we may not. We know that if we become more prominent, more visible, we'll be better compensated, better taken care of. So, greed lurks around in various disguises, and sometimes we don't even know that that's what it is when we see it. I don't know, I could say a little bit. Well, one last thing. Think about the way that products are sold to us. The whole process of greed, or avarice, if you want to use that more stark term, is fueled by our desire to use material things to produce a kind of spiritual or emotional sensation. One of my colleagues at Trinity, who teaches a course in media ministry, she often brings in a bunch of advertisements from magazines and so forth, and we'll hold up something in front of the class, and I meant to grab the New York Times to see what I could find, and I forgot, but it doesn't matter, you'll get the point. Now, here we go, look at this ad. What are they selling? And somebody will say, well, they're selling cars. No, that's the product. I'll ask you in a minute what the product is. I want to know, what are they selling? That's the first, that's how we ought to look at all advertising. The first question we ask ought to be, what are they trying to sell me? And secondly, what's the product? Because usually, what, almost always, what we're being sold is the feeling that comes along with it. And so things are marketed like the powerful car. Buy this car, you'll feel powerful, right? The graceful evening gown. You know, dress this way, you'll feel a certain way. The smart suit. My favorite is the desk organizer. I've spent a lot of money in Staples and office supply places to get organized. And of course, you know, the sexy whatever, the sexy perfume. I mean, sex will sell anything. And so many ads, what are they selling you? They're selling you a sexual feeling. The product can be anything, I mean, virtually. But if it can be linked to making you feel more sexually attractive, potent, whatever, it'll work all too often. So you've got to be on our guard against that. Well, okay. Why don't we let me pause there first of all, and you can find Luke chapter 12 while we're doing that. What comments? Where are you?
In Albion's book, Tuesday with Maury, Maury comments in a discussion on possessions. Now that he's deteriorated, this physical being's deteriorated to a point where nothing can be of any use to him any longer, hardly. He says, he's talking about the gathering of possessions and why you do that. And he says, what do you expect, that they will hug you back?
Yeah, there you go. I gotta read that book. I know about it. Okay. Well, I'm gonna take a look at this parable here. This is Luke chapter 12. We're gonna look at verses 13 through 21. Somebody have that in front of them? Would like to read it for us? Anybody? Volunteer?
I got it.
Appointee? Okay. Tell us what translation you've
got. NRSV.
Okay.
Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Friend, who set me to be a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to him, "Take care. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Then he told them a parable. The land of a rich man produced abundantly. And he thought to himself, "What should I do? For I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich toward God."
Mm-hmm. Go ahead and read the next section there about the lilies of the field.
He said to his disciples, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you will wear. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens, they neither sow nor reap. They have neither storehouse nor barn, and yet God feeds them. And how much more value are you than the birds? And can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your span of life? If then you are not able to do so small a thing as that, why do you worry about the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not clothed like one of these." Go ahead. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, you of little faith? And do not keep striving for what you are to eat and what you are to drink, and do not keep worrying. For it is the nations of the world that strive after all these things, and your Father knows that you need them. Instead, strive for his kingdom, and these things will be given to you as well.
Okay, thanks. Well, here we've got another story about two brothers. We talked about the story of the younger and older brother, the prodigal son, last week. Apparently, this younger brother is asking Jesus' help in getting his older brother to share the family inheritance. Now, I'm not totally always clear how this worked, because there's different versions of what the laws allowed back in those days, but apparently the older brothers got a larger share. That was the common practice. Younger siblings got less. More was expected of the older brother. They were supposed to do more with the family inheritance. But here there was apparently some kind of squabbling over, you know, who got exactly what take and how much, and the younger one felt he was being discriminated against, and obviously a testimony to Jesus' standing in the community by this point, that they were seeking him out as a kind of wise judge of circumstance and so forth. And yet, interestingly, Jesus doesn't seem to want to get involved in this. It's as if he's saying, you know, who am I to judge whose greed is right here? Now, you've got your take, you've got your take. Let me just tell you generally why greed is such a bad thing. So he spins out another parable, a wonderful story. Jesus spent a lot of time, at least as we have it recorded in the New Testament, talking about issues of money and possession and where greed was involved. In fact, one commentator on this passage points out that there are any number of passages throughout the New Testament that give us the sense that greed was a fairly common problem in the early days of the church. It's listed prominently among lists of vices and sins. In Mark's gospel, Jesus has a long list of things about evil intentions, fornication, theft, murder, adultery, avarice, greed, so forth. Colossians and Ephesians both talk about greed in conjunction with idolatry. Colossians 3:5 says, put to death, therefore, whatever in you is earthly, and a number of things, and greed, parenthesis, which is idolatry. Well, this is, I think, a really interesting part of the whole package, this close linkage between greed and idolatry. It helps us see where greed and pride come together. We talk about pride as the putting ourselves in the position of being our own God, our own creator, the severing of relationships with God and others. We get isolated in our prideful state. That's why pride was often at the, most often at the head of the list of deadly sins, the one you had to really get to work on first and combat the hardest, which is why there was a particular day of the week assigned in the medieval church for each sin, and pride was the one you're supposed to work on Sunday, because that was when you got to go to church and take Eucharist and be in community and so forth. Greed was the deadly sin assigned for Thursday. I don't know exactly why. I had to put it somewhere. That's where it ended up. But the linkage of greed and idolatry, I mean, trying to put yourself before God, is a foolish thing. Psalm 14 says, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. And here in this parable, the word comes back to the rich man, you fool, thinking that you could manage all this stuff and save it forever. And maybe that's why Jesus spoke so often about money and the need to have an appropriate perspective on possessions and the things of the world, because he was so intent about the matter of not wanting people to fall into idolatry. This is Jesus, who is the bread of life, as we heard in the sermon here on Sunday. Jesus, who comes that we might have life. Jesus, who is the way, the truth, and the life. This is the same Jesus who, it seems to me, does not want us to settle for anything so mundane a life as simply a life of possessions? Why settle only for that? It just doesn't make any kind of sense. Now, if we have time, which we could go a long way on this, but maybe it's worth our pondering for a moment. Thinking about all the things we may have in our lives that we don't really need, do your own mental inventory there. The story that always comes to mind. Well, that's another time. The real question, though, is once we get some kind of mental inventory there and a picture of all the things in my life I may not really need, what is it that keeps us from giving up or at least reducing some of the excess? And what is it that sometimes allows us to do that? I don't think most of us are uniformly operate the same way at all times on that matter. We have a way of, sometimes we're able to get rid of stuff, and often we just acquire more stuff. I suppose each of us has to do our own searching about whatever that impulse is that creates that. I don't know, any reflections on your own process where accumulation and distribution are involved?
Yeah. I think for me, getting rid of stuff sometimes gives me the feeling of a fresh start.
Uh-huh.
I got rid of that baggage over there and I get a fresh start.
Right. Which, if you let that go too far, can be its own kind of works righteousness.
Right.
I just created my own fresh start. Right. It's true, though. Right. And maybe that's better than not. Although, I'll bet next year you'll be doing a little more. We all will. Right. Yeah. Helpful.
I'm always happy when I bring home less from church rummage sale than I took.
But hey, it was for charity, right?
We moved from a home to a townhouse, smaller, and I told my wife, which she would love to get something new, for everything we get, we must replace it and get rid of something else.
Yeah.
Instead of just storing it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, having some general guidelines like that can really be helpful. Yeah.
What about insecurity as far as savings and the future and things like
right.
that?
Right. What about it?
Well, I mean, it's a driver. It's a driver to save and to be, you know, to be thrifty, and that can go to excess as far as
yeah. The folks of my parents' generation, some of your parents' generation, some of you perhaps who grew up at a time in this world during the Depression years when there was so little and the future was so precarious. I had a colleague like this who retired just a couple of years ago. I mean, he saved everything, and he never paid top dollar for anything. Now, he was famous at rummage sales. I mean, he just could find the niftiest stuff. But there was a mindset that took hold out of that time of so much insecurity about the future. I think one of the interesting things, if you look at sort of the social history of the 20th century, is how that attitude that Depression era kids were forced to grow up with, as they become adults, what often happened to their children, I mean, to people of my generation, just doing life to excess. So tired of that sort of scrimping and saving and worrying about the future that in a greedy sort of way, the desire was to bring the future into the present moment. And that's one of the, we'll see this also with gluttony tomorrow, but greed and gluttony are both driven, in a sense, by a desire not to wait for the future to unfold, but rather to bring as much of the future into right now as I can. And that can be very unhealthy. So again, somewhere in here is the balance between the potentially helpful, healthy impulse to be prepared, to think ahead, to not be a burden on the next generation and so forth, to adequately to save and set aside, and then to do that in a sense of desperation that becomes avaricious. And that is not an easy balance to strike. Again, a potentially healthy impulse here, and then pretty soon we've taken any good thing and done it to excess, and we end up in a bad place. Yeah.
Yeah, well, one of my questions is about the economy as a whole, because you keep hearing that, you know, if you don't buy, the economy goes down, and then we're all in trouble. And so I try to, what's the solution, or what? How do you run an economy where people are buying less rather than more?
Economists. the very first time I was at Holden Village, 24 summers ago, I was on volunteer staff working in the kitchen. We had an economist here, actually, and I remember sitting in on his session just fascinated by all the things that Janice would tell us. I think that was the first time, I was probably in my early 20s then, first time it really came home to me that capitalism is founded on something that ultimately cannot sustain itself. I mean, let's face it, folks, you cannot consume more and more. There is a limit to everything. And an economy and a culture built on consumption eventually, inevitably, will bog down under its own weight unless you're powerful enough to extract what you need out of every other race of people and every other country in the world so that you're the last ones who die off. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And a very long arcing path, that's where we're headed. I don't like to say that. Nobody likes to hear that, but we all participate in it, and it's the truth. You simply cannot consume. And an economy that's driven by consumer spending, I mean, how high can the stock market be? I mean, there's an upper limit to everything. As long as we define ourselves by our possessions, then we're committed to this death dance of doing an economy that way. Our hope lies, I think, in freeing ourselves up from those kinds of impulses. But that's only the most broad sweeping arc, and don't put me in charge of the economy. I don't pretend expertise. I just know that long term, that's not going to work, and I have to keep looking for
alternatives, yeah.
And do what I, act locally in my own situation to make that happen. But others, I mean, I'm not the only one to ever thought about that.
Well, I think if you give your money to charity, it will go into the economy just as much as if you were spending on new couches or new cars. Mm-hmm. It'll just be spent by people with less money, less resources.
Yeah.
But they'll buy food with it, you know, which they need.
Yeah.
You don't need another car.
Yeah. How about the other side of greed? If a person's greedy, is it possible? I don't think it is. To be greedy and compassionate?
No.
So if evil is the lack of good, then greed would be the lack of compassion or charity,
yeah.
Wouldn't it?
Because, as we'll see in a moment, the classic, I'll just say right now, the classic virtue that was prescribed for greed was the virtue of mercy. Now, first you might say, well, that doesn't make it. I mean, you think something like charity or generosity would be, but it was realized that greed is not a victimless crime, so to speak. And this is one of the things we'll see when we get to Scrooge on Friday. Scrooge's greed directly affected the Cratchit family. And this was one of the very difficult things that Scrooge had to confront then in his being walked around by the ghost of Christmas present. He sees the stark conditions of the Cratchits. And so the plea for mercy, I mean, and you may recall in the beginning of the Christmas story, Scrooge is totally merciless. People come by asking if he'd like to make a contribution, if he'd like to buy some meat and drink for the poor at this Christmas season. And they say, what can we put you down for? He says, nothing. And they say, you wish to remain anonymous. He says, I wish to be left alone. I pay my taxes, isn't that enough? But the sense that as he hoards and consumes, it's the outcome for those in London of that time who have not enough is just merciless. they are driven deeper and deeper into poverty. And this was one of Dickens' great gifts, was to highlight this disparity between the best of times and the worst of times, and so forth, and to call on those of means to be more equitable, charitable, merciful. And in that sense, Dickens almost single-handedly rehabilitated the notion of Christmas for the Western world with that one story, and reintroduced an impulse of charity for the season and so forth that had been all but lacking up to that point. So, yeah, I think, I'm not sure that you can say there's anything necessarily good about greed. That's why it's a deadly, deadly sin. I may have said the other day that back on Valentine's Day, the religion editor of our local paper in Columbus, the Dispatch, wanted to do an article on lust. And so he called our seminary public relations director asking, was there somebody he could talk to in our faculty who could give some quotes on lust? She immediately thought of me because the seven deadly sins. And all right, I'll talk to him. And what he really was trying very hard to get me to say was, lust has a real, I mean, there's something positive about that, you know, in a marriage, in a relationship, people have passion. And I said, well, yeah, you can use those other words, passion, whatever, but lust by definition is the misuse of the good gift. And no, I'm not going to say there's anything positive. He was sort of disappointed. I didn't get quoted in his article. You have to say there's something valuable in saving the term for the deadly nature of it, and then I've tried to find other words to talk about the positive side. Okay, let me move on here then, if I can, to say something about human development and end with the virtues. I've been trying to suggest borrowing ideas from Donald Capp's book Deadly Sins and Saving Virtues. It's in the bookstore. Working out of Erik Erikson's life cycle development theory. How at a certain age we face certain crises, and how if we don't work a good resolution to that crisis of that stage, a deadly disposition may develop that follows us through life. And so, I have to read all the fine print here, but just to say, here we have chronologically the stages 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. First stage is 0 to 1 year old, second stage 2 to 3, et cetera, and the 8 stages. Right now, today, we're talking about stage 3, which is where we face the issues of initiative versus guilt. And this is the age of about 3 to 6, the preschool age. I should go over to Narnia and get Trevor, who is now 2 going on 3, and just on the cusp of this. We're still basically in the autonomy shame stage with him, but we're getting the initiative stuff is creeping in around the edges pretty quickly. Well, what's going on at this age? Children are learning to go after things, as Caps points out. Vocabulary is much more developed. They're very mobile. They walk around fully, no more crawling and so forth. Pretty good fine motor control now. They can grab, they can get into, they can, you know, you go out of the room for 2 minutes and you come back and stuff's all over because they've gotten into everything, literally. Kids at this age are physically intrusive. Trevor likes to pinch. He likes to pinch his brother and his sister now. And he just likes to come up and, you know, just sort of get into you, get intrude. Taking lots of initiative, trying things. They're prone to lots of accidents and falling down and dropping because they're very inquisitive and whatnot. The struggle here then is the struggle with taking appropriate initiative. We want kids to try things, you know, experiment, but not break the rules that are in place for their own safety and the safety of others, which is where guilt factors in. You need to have a healthy sense of guilt. Guilt is not altogether bad. I mean, you can have excessive neurotic guilt, of course, but Erikson would say you need enough guilt to keep you from being too much initiative taking. Where we don't develop a healthy sense of limit. And that's really what guilt is about. It's defining the boundaries past which you should not transgress. It's learning the meaning of yes and no. Guilt comes at stage 3 because by then children are verbal and they have a verbal concept of yes and no. You know, do it and don't do it. One of Trevor's favorite books we found in the library here now is a book called Do's and Don'ts. And each page is, it's do brush your teeth, don't brush them with peanut butter. Do wear clean underwear. Don't wear them on your head. You've got the whole thing memorized, you know. Do eat cookies and milk before bed. Don't give yourself a tummy ache. Well, all that works because at this stage they know that there are limits, and yes, this is okay, and no, that isn't okay. If we are indulged, or if we are never taught what limits are and so forth, Erickson would say, this is the place where a greedy disposition can take hold of us very early in life. And we become not only inquisitive, but acquisitive. And we take in without a sense of limit and without a sense of mercy as to how our taking in more is harmful to other people. That's partly why, at this age, I just got to read this. The toddler's creed, have you heard this? Okay, this is so classic. I got these off the internet. If I want it, it's mine. If I give it to you and change my mind later, it's mine. If I can take it away from you, it's mine. If I had it a little while ago, it's mine. If it's mine, it will never belong to anyone, no matter what. If we were building something together, all the pieces are mine. If it looks like mine, it's mine. Well, that's one version. Here's another one. If it's on, I must turn it off. If it's off, I must turn it on. If it's folded, I must unfold it. If it is a liquid, it must be shaken, then spilled. If it is a solid, it must be crumbled, chewed, or smeared. If it's high, it must be reached. If it's shelved, it must be unshelved. If it is pointed, it must be run at. It must be run with top speed. If it has leaves, they must be picked. If it is plugged, it must be unplugged. If it is not trash, it must be thrown away. If it is trash, it must be removed, inspected, and thrown on the floor. If it is closed, it must be opened. If it does not open, it must be screamed at. If it has drawers, they must be rifled. If it is a pencil, it must write on the refrigerator, monitor, or table. If it is full, it will be more interesting empty. If it is empty, it will be more interesting full. If it is a pile of dirt, it must be laid upon. If it is a stroller, it must under no circumstance be ridden in without protest. It must be pushed by me instead. If it has a flat surface, it must be banged upon. If mommy's hands are full, I must be carried. If mommy is in a hurry and wants to carry me, I must walk alone. If it is paper, it must be torn. If it has buttons, they must be pressed. If the volume is low, it must go high. If it is toilet paper, it must be unrolled on the floor. If it is a drawer, it must be pulled open. If it is a toothbrush, it must be inserted into my mouth. Or down the sink, as Trevor did with his last week. If it is a faucet, it must be turned on at full force. If it is a phone, I must talk to it. If it is a bug, it must be swallowed. If it doesn't stay on my spoon, it must be dropped on the floor. If it is not food, it must be tasted. If it is food, it must not be tasted. It's my all-time favorite. If it is dry, it must be made wet with drool, milk, or toilet water. If it is a car seat, it must be protested with arched back. If it is mommy, it must be hugged. I am a toddler. Maybe more than needed, but all of those issues about defining limits, boundaries, what's appropriate, how far can I push this, how much, I mean, yeah, you can let the kid push the button 3 or 4 times, but, you know, how many times, enough is enough, okay, that's as good as a feast, moreover. So, those are the kinds of things that we're trying to learn here in the third stage. Okay, then, one of the things that George Anderson pointed out in that article I mentioned about greed, actually it's a thought from Julian of Norwich, that sin hurts not so much because we get punished for it, although that sometimes is the case, but rather because often we are simply allowed to taste the fruit of our sinning. And that in a sense is our punishment. And when we reap what we sow in greed, this comes back on us in a bad way. This is not the healing of the world. This is not shalom-inducing. Ah, okay. I'll do it in one sentence. Mercy, practice that. It's good to combat greed. The other two things that Erickson suggests are the virtues of purpose and dedication. And what he simply means by that is that at this young stage, this is the stage when children are first beginning to learn to play. And he says, play is work for children. And when you can play in a way that's purposeful, when and children will repeat the same thing over and over and over again, you learn that there is a future toward which things are directed. You learn to do things with commitment and with purpose. And even though you fail, you come back and you try them again. Kids will stack blocks and they'll fall down, but they'll keep trying until they kind of get it. In that sense, you learn to channel your initiative appropriately. And you can stick with a task. That's part of what we all need to learn to do, whatever stage of life we are. Learning to do that appropriately, to find a purpose, to stick with it, to do it with a dedicated set of principles, is one of the ways we keep ourselves focused and off of a greedy and avaricious path. Okay, tomorrow we're going to talk about gluttony, and many of these same issues are going to carry right forward, so if you're able to be here, we'll it takes a slightly different turn, but in principle, a lot of it's the same, and we'll take it on from there. So, thank you.